You are listening to the Krika Lecture Series podcast, produced by the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This and other Krika podcasts are available on SoundCloud and iTunes. For more information about Krika's lecture series and public events, visit our website at krika.wisc.edu.
Hi, everyone. Well, it's really my great pleasure to introduce to you Eric Scott, a professor of history at the University of Kansas and also the editor of the journal The Russian Review. And he's also the head of their Title VI Center over there as well. Professor Scott received his PhD from UC Berkeley in 2011, and his work has been supported by fellowships, very prestigious fellowships, from the ACLS, the NEH, Fulbright Hays, and other grant organizations. Professor Scott's first book is called Familiar Strangers, The Georgian Diaspora and the Evolution of Soviet Empire, and it came out in 2016 with Oxford University Press. And his latest book, which he'll be talking about today, which is really just great, it's called Familiar Strangers, Defectors, right here. Defectors, How the Illicit Fight of Soviets, the Illicit Flight of Soviet Citizens Built the Borders of the Cold War World. Okay. And it came out with Oxford earlier this year. It's really a groundbreaking work of Soviet history, Cold War history, global history. I got a chance to read it early on, and it's also just, it's a fabulous read. Not many history books are like read like a thriller. This book really does. So I highly recommend it to all of you, and probably there's an audio book that, that you can get and read while you take your walks or something as well. Okay, so without further ado, let's give Professor Scott a warm Krika welcome.
Thank you so much, Fran, for that really generous and kind introduction. I'm really thrilled to be here. This is my first trip to Wisconsin, and I'm really trying to make the most out of it here. There's the event today. There's this wonderful conference happening tomorrow, also devoted to borders, which is really a theme that runs through my book. I want to also thank Jennifer for all of her work in setting this up. My counterpart, Irina Shevelenko, for all the great work that Krika is doing. I also want to thank Anthony Carreño and Bree Remus, who helped with a lot of the sort of setting up the materials online and pulling everything together and getting me here to Madison for the first time. So thank you to everyone for setting this up. I'm actually going to pass this around in case people want to look at it while I'm talking. There's a wonderful blurb by someone you'll recognize on the back. So please feel free to have a look. This book was about 10 years in the making. And so, you know, for a book talk, you try to summarize. And I thought a lot about where to begin this talk. And after giving it some thought, I chose to begin today right in the middle of the book with one of my book's main characters in midair. Oksana Kosenkina was a school teacher who was tasked with educating the children of Soviet diplomats, and she was one of around 2,000 Soviet citizens who lived in the United States at the beginning of the Cold War. As a Soviet abroad, her life was largely confined to institutions claimed by her government: the consulate, the school, and the apartment buildings located on Manhattan's Upper East Side, which looked and even smelled like outgrowths of the Soviet homeland, from their Stalinist decor to the smells of cabbage soup cooking in their kitchens. In the summer of 1948, the sense of isolation among this community of Soviet citizens grew with the start of the Berlin blockade and the hardening of Cold War battle lines in Europe. Yet on an August afternoon that summer, Kosenkina, the schoolteacher, found herself briefly between borders as she jumped from the third floor of the Soviet consulate and was suspended for one brief moment between the reach of the socialist superpower and the jurisdiction of the NYPD. A tangle of telephone wires located below the window broke her fall and probably saved her life. With a crowd of activists and reporters looking on, New York police officers breached the compound, and they engaged in what would later be described as a, quote, tussle with consular staff before searching her room and loading her onto an ambulance bound for Roosevelt Hospital. She gave a filmed interview from her hospital bed, proclaiming that she had been held prisoner inside the consulate. Soviet officials were barred from her room. The Soviet ambassador, Alexander Konyushkin, delivered a furious note to the State Department complaining that the NYPD had, quote, violated the extraterritoriality, end quote, of the Soviet consulate, in effect claiming the consulate as a piece of Soviet territory in the middle of Manhattan. Kosenkina's jump was proclaimed a leap to freedom in the American press, yet this narrative belied a far more ambivalent story. In fact, Kosenkina had already fled the consulate once before and publicly returned of her own free will. Less than 2 weeks earlier, with the Soviet school where she taught set to close and a ticket home booked for her on the Soviet ship Pavieta, she had sought refuge at the Tolstoy Foundation's Reed Farm, which was a sanctuary for those fleeing the Soviet Union, run by the famous author's youngest daughter, Alexandra Tolstoy, just outside of New York City. Yet Kosenkina felt uncomfortable at Reed Farm, resenting in particular the chores she was given in the farm's kitchen, and surrounded, she later alleged, by, quote, white Russian monarchists who regarded her as an object of curiosity, if not outright suspicion, end quote. She posted a frantic letter to Soviet consul Yakov Lomakin, asking to be picked up. And when the black car that was dispatched from the consulate to Reed Farm arrived, she got in. Soon after, she appeared at the consulate alongside Lomakin at a press conference, claiming she had been rescued from a kidnapping by reactionary emigres. Anti-Soviet activists argued otherwise, and they surrounded the consulate and obtained a writ from a New York court demanding that she appear the next day in the courtroom. The very day that she was due to appear in court, she instead leapt from the building's window, and Time magazine later sought to summarize this confusing itinerary for American readers in this image you see here. In many ways, Kosenkina was far from the ideal defector. She had no intelligence value to speak of, and she had this confusing backstory. After publicity had dwindled and a ghost-written memoir, inevitably titled Leap to Freedom, had been rushed to press, her American handlers found her difficult and demanding. She spent her final years living in a hotel room in Miami under an assumed name, writing a novel that would remain unpublished. Shortly before she died, it seems that she reached out to the Soviet embassy, but would only speak to the man they dispatched through her door. The Soviet government also found her perplexing. In private discussions, Soviet foreign ministry officials speculated about her mental health, and they hewed to this notion that she had initially been kidnapped. In their view, though, the bigger scandal had been the flagrant violation of their consular compound and President Truman's subsequent decision to expel the Soviet consul. This set into motion the closure of Soviet consulates in the U.S. and U.S. consulates in the Soviet Union for the next 24 years. In my book, Kosenkina's defection is one of many I trace across the globe over a period of nearly five decades. But I've chosen to begin my talk with Kosenkina's story, as confounding as it might be, because I think its ambivalent qualities are representative of the experiences of many defectors in the Cold War. This was not what I expected when I set out to write the book. Defection, as it's depicted in spy novels or dramatized in films and celebrated in Western news coverage, is typically described as a one-way journey from so-called socialist captivity to the free West. And I think perhaps because of the simplistic Cold War narrative, it's often been dismissed or taken for granted by historians. But in following the global journeys of Soviet defectors over the Cold War's evolution and tracing their stories through over 20 state and private archives in five different countries, and in examining recently declassified KGB documents, as well as looking beyond the traditional confines of Soviet historiography, I uncovered a richer and more curious history, a history that in some ways builds on my first book, which is a study of internal migration and multi-ethnic diaspora within the Soviet Union, but one that follows the movement of Soviet citizens across state lines, a history that tries to place Soviet migrants in their global context and bring together scholarship on the Cold War, decolonization, and international law. There's been a whole recent wave of scholarship that's emphasized that the Cold War was a time of globalization and decolonization. I argue that it was also in response to these two trends, an era in which the superpowers aimed to construct global mobility regimes to manage the rising international flows of people. And they did so in a way that suited their ambitions as sprawling global empires that rose even as the old empires of Europe fell. One regime which was directed by the US and upheld by its allies was devoted to managing entry and selectively attracting certain classes of citizens, of migrants, to make them citizens. The other, maintained by the Soviet Union and most other socialist states, was intent on retaining and returning its wayward citizens. Both mobility regimes were supported by vast legal infrastructures that spanned the globe. Defection, which I define as an unauthorized exit viewed as an ideological choice, most often occurred in the spaces between these two global mobility regimes. In the course of my research, I came to see defection as a joint production, constructed by the criminalization of emigration by socialist states, the strategic encouragement of departure by capitalist states, and the tactics of migrants who sought to navigate with varying degrees of success the era's shifting political and legal terrain. I think defection needs to be understood as a transnational phenomenon, but one that tested and ultimately helped to reinforce Cold War borders. Defectors were both the catalyst for the bordering of previously open spaces and the most visible representatives of the consequences of these spaces' enclosure. The global journeys of defectors brought state power into contested spaces, into displaced persons camps, where migrants were identified, sorted, and redirected after the Second World War, around extraterritorial outposts like the Soviet consulate, which became places of flight and also asylum seeking, into the high seas of the Pacific, where Soviet sailors jumped ship, and into the skies above, where defectors hijacked planes to fly abroad. Over time, disputes over defectors helped map out the contours of state sovereignty in a way that suited the imperial ambitions of the superpowers. My findings support the notion that Cold War borders were more fluid and less static than previously thought. And this is in line with a lot of recent scholarly work on the subject. My book also suggests that competition for defectors eventually paved the way for tacit collusion between the superpowers, who found common cause in regulating the spaces through which defectors moved. To maintain their authority in the face of post-colonial unrest, the Soviet Union and the US sought to lock newly independent countries into a set of rules governing diplomatic missions, the high seas, and airspaces. And in the end, most states, whether old or new, post-colonial or otherwise, were threatened by spontaneous forms of migration, which defectors epitomized. Each chapter of my book looks at a different type of border in its global context at a time when that border came to the fore of the Cold War. Now, in the rest of my talk, I'll offer a series of snapshots of these Cold War fault lines, but I'll focus on the book's two main parts, building borders and governing global mobility. The first part emphasizes competition. The second part begins to describe the outlines of the collusion I'm talking about. Or to put it in the framework of Gasekina's story, the first part attempts to explain why she jumped, and the second part, how borders were reinforced after her so-called leap to freedom. The Second World War, where the book begins, was the largest instance of migration in Europe's history, and set the stage for a clash between the Soviet Union and the US over the masses of people displaced by the conflict. Soviet citizens were the largest group of displaced persons, or DPs, numbering over 5 million people. Although most were eventually repatriated, some sought to remain abroad. In the camps that held them, new techniques were introduced to screen and categorize people, and new organizations were established to supervise their care and resettlement. While DPs were an ethnically and politically diverse group, their decision to remain was increasingly cast as a political choice by both the US and the Soviet Union. Migrants hoping to remain in the West, particularly those interested in reaching the United States, learned to navigate these systems of categorization by telling stories that emphasized their resistance to communism. These stories gained international attention at events like the trial of Soviet defector Viktor Kravchenko in Paris in 1949. This was billed at the time as the trial of the century, and Kravchenko called on DPs as key witnesses in making his case against the Soviet Union. This brought previously unknown people like Olga Marchenko, who you can see here on the right, an unassuming middle-aged woman from rural Soviet Ukraine into the global spotlight alongside the generals and other high officials that the Soviet Union brought as witnesses for its part. By this time, by 1949, the discourse of defection had begun to supplant the notion of displacement. This framing was supported by anti-Soviet emigre organizations like the Tolstoy Foundation, which received funding from the US government, but also pushed American authorities toward a more active role in encouraging defection. A pamphlet published by the Tolstoy Foundation, entitled "Who Are the DPs?" obscured this history of forced displacement by describing them in capital letters as people who left because they did not believe in communism. The lines defining DPs from defectors grew blurrier as post-war migrants from the Soviet Union joined those already in the camps. The latest Soviet migrants became seen as a source of strategic knowledge. A series of so-called sponge reports produced by the State Department, and they were called that because they squeezed Soviet migrants for information, detailed in information that was useful and intended both for academics and for intelligence officials, information about Soviet institutions, relations between Soviet nationalities, and the role of religion in the socialist state. People identified as defectors appeared in interview subjects in the Harvard Project on the Soviet Social System, which was a $1 million project funded by the US Air Force that surveyed over 2,000 migrants and became a foundational primary source for American Sovietology. And indeed, defectors were very integral to the sort of foundation of area studies knowledge on the Soviet Union in the early Cold War. The Soviet government, too, relied on migrants and interrogated those who returned, not only about what they did in the West, but about conditions there, and of course, the locations of fellow citizens who chose to remain abroad. Responding to the influx of migrants, the interests of the intelligence community, and a sense of heightened competition with the USSR, the US formally established a defector program in April 1951. According to classified US policy guidance, defectors had to possess two qualities. One, they had to have escaped from the control of the USSR, or countries in the Soviet orbit. And two, they had to be of special interest to the US government, whether because of their intelligence value or because they could be, quote, exploited in the psychological field. This last part was particularly important because it privileged daring escapes by previously unknown individuals and not just the flight of high-ranking KGB officers with lots of intelligence to offer. A government memorandum that preceded the policy in 1949 acknowledged that events like the dramatic defection of Kosenkina, quote, did more to arouse the Western world to the realities of the nature of communist tyranny than anything else since the end of the war. And so in this sense, the unexpected flight of a schoolteacher helped forge the outlines of the US's defector policy. The defector program was classified. In fact, some of its details still remain classified to this day by the US. But it was closely connected with a publicly proclaimed escapee program that was launched in 1952 and promoted the idea of the West as a sanctuary for those fleeing communism. The 1951 Refugee Convention, which was forged with significant US involvement, cemented the international asylum system for those who fled persecution for their political opinion or were unwilling to return. The US also funded the creation of escapee centers to house refugees from the socialist bloc. Like DP camps, these were billed as humanitarian ventures, but they were also places where US officials screened migrants and assessed their intelligence value and their potential for psychological exploitation, as it was known. Some were run by the very same emigre groups that had first advocated for Soviet DPs, including the Tolstoy Foundation, which ran the Karlsfeld Center, which you can see here, located just outside Munich, Germany. This flowchart, which was produced in 1954, shows the way the US government hoped flight from the Soviet Union would go. After this frantic escape, an initial screening preceded reception, and those who were suspected of acting at the behest of Soviet intelligence would be detained. Migrants who were not deemed suspicious and allowed to proceed would be registered, fed, clothed, rehabilitated, which was a term that was used at the time, given professional training and language instruction, and then either integrated locally in Europe or resettled abroad. However, defectors rarely traveled this neat itinerary. Many were held for lengthy interrogations, their identities and their motivations often difficult to discern. Some had difficulty getting employment unless they could provide intelligence. Moreover, there are some fundamental tensions underlying this whole program. First of all, escape was a haphazard process, as the first element of this chart suggests. A U.S. escapee program newsletter from 1958 praised socialist citizens who fled by driving stolen military vehicles, commandeering naval vessels, and even hijacking airplanes at gunpoint. All of these acts, as we'll see, proved highly destabilizing in practice to the emerging infrastructure of globalization. The second problem was that there was not a clear plan in any of the documents I looked at of what to do if the number of migrants rose beyond the handful of people shown in this poster. U.S. National Security Council documents show that mass defection from the Soviet Union was encouraged with the expectation that Soviet control, quote, would not result in the defection of more than a few hundred Soviet citizens per year, end quote. In private, U.S. policymakers believed that by encouraging defection, the USSR would in fact tighten its borders. And so by encouraging flight, the program played a part in solidifying the border policies of its communist foe. And so, in effect, the dividing lines of the Cold War were mutually constituted through the competition for defectors. Notably, the defector in the escapee program did not involve any major changes to America's rather restrictive immigration system. The U.S. funded an asylum system that was designed to keep most migrants in Europe or move them to places like Australia or South America. The majority did not reach the United States, although those who were deemed defectors had the best chance of reaching American shores. And I think most striking of all, this flowchart moved in only one direction. It did not anticipate the possibility of return. In 1955, the Soviet Union borrowed from the American playbook to launch their own front organization, encouraging the return of wayward Soviet citizens. It was called the Committee for the Return to the Homeland, and it was backed by the KGB, although technically a citizens' initiative. Although its headquarters were located just across the street from the Soviet embassy in East Berlin, so they didn't really try too hard to make it appear independent. The committee used many of the same tools honed by the U.S. State Department and the CIA in an attempt to control defectors as well as the stories people told about them. The committee held press conferences with defectors who chose to return home, which mirrored the State Department's orchestrated press events with defectors who had fled. While the CIA funded Radio Free Europe through a front organization, the Soviet committee operated its own radio station and published a newspaper, which you can see here. The paper was full of emotional appeals to return. There was always a section towards the back, usually on page 4 or 5, that included letters written by relatives in the Soviet Union looking for loved ones abroad, with you know, emotionally on-the-nose headlines like, "Where are you, my son? Don't you want to see your daughter again?" The Soviet motherland was in this way woven out of these emotional family ties. Now, like their American counterparts, Soviet officials saw defectors as ripe for psychological exploitation. They crafted cautionary tales of defectors being disenchanted with life in the West for Soviet readers, and they offered redemptive stories about those who returned home. The campaign rested on a massive intelligence effort. The relatives of defectors' family members were spied on, they were pressed to write letters, and they were sometimes even dispatched abroad by the KGB to encourage their relatives to return home in person. Nearly all those who did return home faced some form of punishment, though at the KGB's request, sentences for defectors who recanted or participated in efforts like this were lessened. The numbers of those who returned home were small, less than 8,000 by one estimate, but the threat of what American officials called, quote, redefection, muddied the distinction between the Free West and the captive East. At one point, the CIA's consul general even mulled the possibility of having U.S. immigration agents at major airports detained defectors who wanted to redefect. Although he ultimately shied away from imposing exit restrictions that really would have obviously resembled those in place in the Soviet Union. Behind the scenes, both Soviet and American intelligence officers puzzled over the real motivations of most defectors. Writing in the closed CIA journal Studies in Intelligence, one CIA officer quipped, quote, "You hear of ideological defectors, but when you deal with Soviets, you seldom meet one," end quote. He advised fellow officers tasked with identifying potential defectors to, quote, "look for a Soviet up to his ears in trouble." A colleague of his, also with the CIA, was even less charitable, calling defectors, quote, "perversities of human nature." Another CIA officer described him in the same journal as, quote, "egotistical dilettantes." Ironically, these assessments resembled the KGB's own internal studies, which emphasized things like career issues, family troubles, egotism, and psychological vulnerability as factors that made people likely to defect. With the construction of the Berlin Wall in 1961, crossing Cold War Europe became much more difficult. Defection became at once more global, but also more localized along the borders of the USSR. Soviet citizens lucky enough to be cleared for travel abroad defected by fleeing embassies, ships, and airplanes. Those who were not cleared for foreign travel took their chances along the state's southern border with Turkey, which became the primary destination for defection after the wall went up. Historians have tended to tell two different stories about the borders of the Soviet Union itself. Either these borders were effective instruments of enclosure that grew harder over time, institutions of isolation, in the words of one historian, or they were porous zones of international exchange that were never quite controlled by the state. A closer look at these borders from the perspective of defection, drawing in large part on the declassified records of the KGB's Western Border District, which was based in Kyiv, Ukraine, where I did a lot of my research on the subject, reveals that post-Stalinist mobility regime consisted of both regulated openings as well as enforced closures. And as the Cold War settled into a more long-term economic and cultural contest, Soviet border defenses grew more refined. Along this border, you had zones of mobility and immobility coexisting in relative proximity. And this was best seen in places like the Black Sea port city of Batumi, located down here in present-day Georgia, a border zone I'll talk more about in my talk for the conference tomorrow. In my book, I look at the journey of two young men seeking to flee from Batumi to Turkey with a stolen map and a handheld propeller that they were going to use to move through the water. This bustling city was visited by foreign tourists and plugged into global shipping, yet it lay only a few miles from a so-called forbidden border zone that ran along the south of Batumi along the Turkish border that was only open to screened local residents and border troops. The post-Stalinist Soviet Union, as historians have argued, was an eager participant in international trade and welcomed foreign visitors and the hard currency they brought. But it also engaged globalization through maritime shipping while restraining human mobility in some significant ways. These restraints were most obvious in the forbidden border zone, a sliver of territory with high voltage fences, watchtowers, and detachments of armed troops who patrolled with guard dogs. Even the details of this terrain were kept classified, and this is why these two would-be defectors approached the area with a stolen map that they had stolen from a state enterprise in Tbilisi. But these restraints also operated in subtler ways. Local residents were paid hundreds of rubles, which was a substantial sum, for apprehending defectors. Informant networks were secretly run through the port city's cafes, and the KGB came to rely on what it called prophylactic policing, visiting people overheard saying favorable things about life abroad to stop defection before it happened. And Batumi was just one link in a chain that ran deep into the socialist camp. The KGB coordinated with Warsaw Pact allies to apprehend Soviets who had fled into countries like Poland, even decades, in some cases, after their flight. It also, as I found, spied on its Polish counterparts to ensure their obedience in enforcing a common socialist mobility regime overseen by Moscow. And so the so-called Iron Curtain was by no means monolithic, but it's some cases seem rather rickety, but it proved remarkably effective in limiting defection across the Soviet Union's territorial borders for the duration of the Cold War. It managed the mobility of millions of people, with only a handful of people managing to escape each year. And so for this reason, the second half of the book moves beyond these territorial borders to the broader world of the Cold War. The book's second half, Governing Global Mobility, looks at how competition for individual defectors continued, even as the superpowers began to jointly regulate the border to world they had built. And this takes us back to what happened after Kosenkin had jumped from the consulate. Her dramatic exit and the media coverage it generated drew a lot of imitators. In fact, the CIA launched its so-called Red Cap program to target Soviets posted abroad who were, quote, chafing at the restricted and highly organized Soviet embassy existence. However, American diplomats did not know how to respond to the larger number of Soviet citizens who began showing up unannounced at U.S. embassies to seek asylum. Under international law, it was very difficult to classify someone who showed up at an embassy as a political refugee, since that person technically remained in the country where the embassy was located. However, State Department guidance in 1958 carved out a special exception for individuals who were considered desirable as defectors if they could be deemed of value for intelligence purposes. The problem was, though, that the guidance remained secret, and so Soviet citizens were kept guessing whether they would be eligible for protection after they took the risk of entering a U.S. embassy. To give one example, in September 1959, Leonid Markovsky, a Soviet citizen from Kyiv, entered the grounds of the U.S. embassy in Moscow by walking in behind a vehicle with diplomatic plates. Although the staff urged him to leave, he managed to ensconce himself in the ninth floor reception room and told them a story about attempting to cross the Soviet-Finnish border illegally several years earlier. For this, Markovsky had been subjected to 18 months imprisonment as a psychiatric patient. Embassy officials were unsure what to do, and so they do what bureaucrats don't know what to do when they don't know what to do, which is create a file on him. And they asked him to sit for a photograph and attached the photograph to this report that he gave them. They typed it up. And then they escorted him out of the embassy and left him standing in the streets of the Soviet capital, probably observed by the Soviet police who stood outside the embassy. It turned out that the Soviet side was just as wary of what they called walk-ins. A guide written by Ivan Serov, who headed the KGB, warned of uninvited migrants who showed up at Soviet embassies. At best, Serov believed that such people were sympathetic but misguided individuals who claimed to offer important documents but ultimately provided no intelligence value. At worst, he said, they might be imposters or spies. These debates about the legality and the desirability of diplomatic asylum took place against the backdrop of decolonization. In the decade following Kosenkin's leap to freedom from 1948 to 1958, the number of states operating embassies nearly doubled. Moreover, some post-colonial leaders spoke of a future where their countries would be less confined by national borders, and the role of embassies would be reimagined. At the 1955 Conference of African and Asian States held in Bandung, Indonesia, post-colonial delegates spoke of new regional and transnational solidarities. A number of states, particularly states in Latin America, called for a dramatic expansion of the refugee system by codifying the right of migrants to seek asylum in embassies. If you recall, when the New York police entered the Soviet consulate after Kosenkin's jump, the Soviet ambassador denounced it as a violation of the consulate's extraterritoriality. In truth, however, there was no comprehensive legal framework that defined the borders of consulates and embassies. The drive to mark off these borders picked up pace over the course of the 1950s, as unrest surrounded embassies on both sides of the Iron Curtain. The Soviet embassy in Tel Aviv was attacked in 1953. Romanian emigres seized their home country's mission in Switzerland in 1955. And US embassies in Taiwan and Turkey were attacked in 1957 and 1958. There was even more unrest swirling around British and French embassies in the post-colonial world, with diplomats concerned about missions being overwhelmed by post-colonial migrants with claims to British and French citizenship. Such concerns were underpinned by implicit and sometimes very explicit racism toward non-white people who sought to move to the former imperial metropole. In 1957, the UN's International Law Commission began to draft guidelines to expand the reach of international law around embassies. While most expected the process to be derailed by Cold War divisions, a remarkable consensus soon emerged on the basic outlines of an agreement. Both the US and the Soviet Union were interested in protecting the diplomatic missions abroad, and the push to wall off these missions from unwanted migrants was supported by France, Britain, and other European states in the process of shedding colonial holdings. Even though the Soviet Union continued to speak on the behalf of post-colonial states and even supported a resolution of the Afro-Asian Bandung Conference denouncing Western embassies as, quote, centers for neo-colonial control, the Soviet Union found common cause with the United States and Europe's fading empires in fortifying diplomatic outposts. The Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, which was held in 1961 in Austria, was billed as a gathering where established states and new states like Ghana, which had gained independence just the year before, were supposed to be on equal footing. In practice, a shared understanding between the US and the Soviet Union established the framework of the agreement, and the two sides worked together to push back challenges to their notion of diplomatic inviolability. Superpowers ushered their respective blocs through the process, and Britain and France sought to do the same with their former colonies. In the final analysis, post-colonial states shared with the former colonial rulers a fundamental distrust of migrants, and many of these states were not keen on having their citizens emigrate to the former metropole. They were concerned about the demographic and state of their countries. They were concerned about brain drain. East joined with West to turn the debates into a discussion between North and South, but ultimately states, both old and new, banded together in Vienna against more spontaneous forms of migration and more porous forms of citizenship. Soviet concerns arising from Kosenkina's defection were incorporated into the agreement, as the convention declared that diplomatic personnel should be protected from prosecution and that diplomatic premises were not to be entered without permission. 2 years later, a second conference in Vienna extended these protections to consulates. After both agreements were ratified by Congress, Soviet consulates in the U.S., closed since Kosenkina's leap, reopened. The Vienna Convention was also highly significant for what it did not include and what it left unsaid. In the interest of regulating migration, the proposal of Latin American countries to establish a right to diplomatic asylum was beaten back repeatedly, both by the U.S. and the Soviet Union. In terms of the convention, the practice was neither codified nor was it prohibited. This exclusion was maintained in the name of what they called flexibility, which was namely the flexibility of strong states who had the power to determine what constituted an exceptional case that merited diplomatic protection. In line with Italian philosopher Giorgio Agamben's argument that sovereignty rests in the power to proclaim the exception, established states with the superpowers at the fore retained the right to decide what was allowed and not allowed in this deliberately ambiguous corner of international law. Meanwhile, migrants approaching embassies received no guarantees, and less powerful states lacked a set of universal rights to appeal to. After Vienna, stronger states still practiced this form of extraterritoriality when they wished. In fact, at the end of the decade, the U.S. would use its mission in New Delhi to offer asylum to Svetlana Allilueva, Stalin's daughter. And for its part, the Soviet Union supported the right of nearly 8,000 people seek refuge in diplomatic missions following the coup against President Allende in Chile, and later resettled a good number of them inside the USSR. But both superpowers colluded to draw borders around embassies in a way that privileged states over migrants and strong states over weaker ones. To really drive home this point, had the Vienna Convention been in place when Kosenkina jumped, New York police officers would have been barred from entering the Soviet consulate. And to return to that story of Leyla Markovsky, the man who walked into the U.S. Embassy in Moscow only to be turned away, Soviet records that I later found revealed that he did eventually escape across the Soviet border, going through this forbidden zone into Turkey. And so I think it's notable that ultimately this very risky journey on land through this heavily guarded border zone was a more viable path to leaving the Soviet Union for a non-elite person and claiming asylum in an embassy. The way that cases like Kosekin's were resolved reveals something of a coordinated approach between the US and the Soviet Union in setting these rules to govern the world's borderlands. And this played out not only around embassies, but also on the high seas, as well as in airspaces, where cases of defection brought the Soviet Union and the US into conflict, but ultimately became a means of advancing superpower governance. On the high seas, the 1954 seizure of a Soviet tanker, the Tuapse, by Taiwanese authorities in the international waters of the South China Sea, and the subsequent defection of its crew, was certainly a major point of contention between the Soviet Union and the US. American officials tacitly supported the seizure, while Soviet officials denounced it as an act of piracy at the UN. The KGB and the Soviet Foreign Ministry did what they could to track and return crew members as they were scattered across the world. Some had been brought to the US, others were resettled in South America, and some remained on Taiwan. Through appeals and the efforts of KGB officers, often operating undercover through Soviet embassies, through these efforts, most of the missing sailors were returned to the Soviet Union. And in my book, I have a map sort of charting out the global journeys of this crew following the ship's seizure here in the South China Sea. But even as Soviet spies were dispatched abroad, the Soviet Union and the US reached a series of agreements that carved out superpower exceptions at the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea in Geneva in 1958. The Tuapse incident figured into the negotiations. The convention at once established free navigation for ships like the Tuapse, but it also strengthened the control flag states had on board ships. In essence, it helped write a number of the restrictions the Soviet Union hoped to place on its sailors into international law. Finally, cases of defection in the skies led to tighter restrictions on air travel. My book's last chapter looks at the aftermath of the first successful hijacking of a Soviet civilian aircraft, which occurred in 1970. The hijackers, a Soviet-Lithuanian father and son, cast themselves as ideologically motivated defectors whose desire for freedom justified the violent seizure of a plane and the death of its flight attendant. But the pair were essentially stuck in Turkey for years after the hijacking, which took the plane from Batumi to Trabzon. And they were essentially stuck there in Turkey because after their hijacking, the Soviet Union and the US began to work together to forge an international legal framework that gave no quarter to hijackers. Receiving a good deal of assistance from the Lithuanian diaspora, the father and son were ultimately spirited out of the country, first to Vatican City and then to Venezuela. The US did not want to take them in, but the pair later managed to enter the US illegally. However, they lived out the rest of their lives in hiding under assumed names. And they met a violent end, one which I describe in my book, and if you ask me about it, I'll talk more about during Q&A. This unusual and unexpected fate was, you know, definitely multi-causal, but I think it arose ultimately from the pair's growing sense of isolation as states on opposite sides of the Cold War banded together to prevent unplanned journeys through the skies. Although defection all but disappeared with the end of the Cold War, it, I think, helped define the borders of our globalized world in some enduring ways. Defection really underpinned the refugee system we still have today, one that prioritizes migrants with political claims and routes them through a global system of screening and holding camps that keeps many migrants stuck in the post-colonial world in camps like this one, which you see in Turkey at the edge of the EU. We tend to associate globalization with the opening of borders. And while it's true that most restrictions on exit were lifted in 1991, there are far more rules in place today governing mobility through embassies, maritime zones, and airports than there were at the start of the Cold War. There are also much stronger mechanisms for surveillance to enforce these rules. My book argues that globalization was not only about increased movement, but also about the development of more sophisticated means for sorting and governing migration flows. The Cold War started as a superpower contest, but by the conflict's end, the US and the Soviet Union generally agreed about the need to stamp out more spontaneous forms of global mobility. The US quietly retreated from its promotion of escape by any means. And by the 1970s, the Soviet Union even began dumping political opponents abroad rather than expending resources trying to bring them home. The demise of defection coincided with the rise of stateless people, who are generally free to leave but have few places to go. While the Soviet Union is no more and defectors are perhaps a thing of the past, the agreements forged in their wake remain in place and continue to shape the pathways of millions on the move in the world today. Thank you.